Wow, we're almost done with the class. And what class is this? This is Bio 231, Human Anatomy, and it is May 13th. And we're going to finish up urinary system and move into diversification system. And I had a question regarding the lab quiz. At least one of the lab quizzes, number 10. And yes, there will be an extra credit if you can draw and label a nephron, all the tubular elements, vascular elements. I didn't ask you to do that, but the 8 o'clock lab, I gave all lab, all the whole period, to study that and get it down pat. And did anybody opt out of that extra credit drawing? I think everybody did it. Probably everybody got 100%, haven't graded it yet. So I think that is good for you to do that, right? Okay. Any questions over what we covered last time? As I turn some of these lights down. We're all pretty good. All right, let's take a look at the schedule real quick. So let's see, here's the schedule. Today I said was the 13th. Indeed it is. And we are going to go into diversification system as soon as I clear up a couple issues with urinary system. Okay, who's horsing around over there? I see some people horsing around. So just don't disturb anybody that's around you, okay? All right, so that's the schedule, except that next week, the Monday group and the Wednesday groups have a practicum, and on Monday morning and Wednesday morning, that practicum is going to be at 9 o'clock. You don't have to be here at 8 o'clock because it's just a short test, as usual, and I'll be here at 8 o'clock to open up the study room. If you want to look at the models before the practicum, that's fine. Usually I'm here about 7:30, something like that. I'll open it up then. And then on Wednesday, 1 week from today, is exam 4, chapters 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. So we've got to finish up 24 and get into 25 today. And also notice this, the Wednesday labs will have a practicum and their last lecture exam on the same day, but the material is the same, so hopefully you get a lot of rest the night before so that you're not too fatigued by the time all these tests are over. But you should know the information, right? You should know the information. You should have fun on that practicum, showing off what you know. All right, so that is the schedule. And then after that, there is something after May 20th. What comes after May 20th? It's not on the schedule, but there is something after May 20th. It is on the 21st. Yes, there's the online quiz. Remember, that is due every Thursday at 11 p.m. And maybe it's done right now because you can work ahead, and hopefully it is done by now. But don't forget to do that. Don't push it off till after the exam, and then after the exam, completely forget about it because you don't want a zero on any of those quizzes. Right? You can get a bad grade, but a zero is tough. It's hard to average a zero back to a passing grade. All right, so that is the schedule and the remainder of the things that you have to do. All right, so let's get back to the urinary system. So you see the slide on the right, I'm sorry, on the left, and I think I'm going to go over the filtration membrane first, filtration membrane, and then I'm going to go into juxtaglomerular apparatus. And here is something that you're familiar with. So here is a cortical radiate artery bringing blood to an afferent arteriole, which brings it into Bowman's capsule, and the capillary inside Bowman's capsule is glomerulus, right? And so there is pressure in this blood vessel, so molecules will leak out because this is a special leaky capillary. We're going to talk about that in just a second. And that fluid that's in Bowman's capsule then proceeds through the rest of the tubes of the tubular elements of the nephron. All right, so here's Bowman's capsule. What does it really look like? Something like this, right? So here's Bowman's capsule. Here is that proximal convoluted tubule. And Bowman's capsule makes this little spherical structure, but notice the cells fold back on top of the afferent arteriole and also cover the glomerulus itself. So this layer that makes Bowman's capsule and the layer that's right on the glomerulus is basically the same level. It just folded back on each other, and that you should recognize as a serous membrane. Right? A serous membrane It is a membrane that lines the cavity that's not open to the outside world. And it's got three parts. The part that's right on the visceral organ is called the visceral serous membrane. So these cells that we call podocytes that are right on the surface of the glomerulus are what we call the visceral part of the glomerulus, of the Bowman's capsule, right? Visceral layer of Bowman's capsule. And you can see that there are a lot of separations between these processes coming out, and that's what fluid actually can leak through to get into Bowman's capsule. All right, so here's the visceral division. As the cells migrate over here and form the outer part of the capsule, then this is what we call the parietal layer, right? Visceral is on the surface of the organ. Parietal is on the outside, and then you have something like serous fluid in between them. But in this particular case, what's the name of the fluid between the visceral and the parietal Bowman's capsule or glomerular capsule? What is this fluid right here? Y'all should, I think, should know this. That is filtrate. Yeah, because the process of that fluid leaving the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule is called filtration. And the product that goes through the membrane is what we call filtrate. Sometimes it's called ultrafiltrate because they're microscopic, but we just call it filtrate. And then what is this first tube coming out of Bowman's capsule? Yeah, proximal convoluted tubule. And what kind of fluid does a proximal convoluted tubule have? Yeah, filtrate in there. Okay, and in the glomerulus you have blood, right, with plasma, and that plasma leaks out. All right, so these things are called podocytes because of these projections, these processes reminded somebody of feet. And if we zoom way in to one loop of the glomerulus, here I can see a podocyte and all these little processes, these foot processes sticking up. And these are what we call filtration slits. The space between the foot processes, and these are relatively large and very leaky, so material can leak right out of them. Here is the endothelium of the glomerulus, and you can see it has large pores. These large pores we call fenestrations, and this also enhances the leakage of fluid out of the glomerulus or your blood into Bowman's capsule to become filtrate. And this is a special fenestrated kind of capillary. Nice electron micrograph of what we were talking about. So here are the three parts of the filtration membrane. Here we have a capillary. What's inside this capillary? Blood. And one component of blood is plasma. Plasma is the fluid part of blood. Plasma doesn't contain red blood cells or white blood cells or platelets, but plasma contains everything else, all the fluid parts. So plasma can leak through a fenestration, right, in the endothelium of the capillary, because this is a fenestrated capillary, and there's even large intercellular clefts or intercellular spaces between the cells that make up the capillary, right? And then here is the basement membrane for the endothelium, and then here is, or here are the foot processes from the podocyte, and again, you can see large spaces. So fluid can move very easily from the blood right into Bowman's capsule. This is the three parts of the filtration membrane. All right, so that's really a really nice picture. All right, so I had you draw a nephron, and you became very familiar with a nephron, but there is one important detail that I did not make a big deal of, and it's actually really important. And it has to do with something that helps regulate blood pressure and helps regulate how the kidney functions. Okay, so, and that's called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Let me see if it's shown right here. Pretty complicated figure. All right, so let's see if I can trace this around. So here is, oh, there's no way. Proximal convoluted tubule, too many twists and turns to it. And the distal convoluted tubule goes right between the, oh, I guess I can see it here. All right, let me zoom in. Good enough. All right, so here is it. Do you believe me? Here's a collecting duct. Collecting duct right here, straight tube. And what part of the nephron empties into the collecting duct? Is it a loop of Henle? Is it a convoluted tubule? And if it's a convoluted tubule, which one? Is the one far away from Bowman's capsule or close to it? Well, it's attached to the collecting duct, so it's got to be one that's far away, right? So here is the distal convoluted tubule. Let's trace it back and look where it goes. It goes right between the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole. This space right in here is what we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So let's zoom into this area. So this is really important for regulating blood pressure in the long term and also regulating how much urine is produced or how much filtrate is being produced at any one moment. All right, so this is where we are. I think you've got a pretty good orientation of that. So the juxtaglomerular apparatus is this thing right here. So here's proximal convoluted tubule. We're going to work our way back. So here is what the parietal layer of Bowman's capsule. And then here is the visceral layer, what we were just talking about, afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole, which is bringing blood into the glomerulus and out of the glomerulus. And between the afferent and efferent arteriole, we have a tube passing right between them. I just described what that tube is, right? Does anybody know what that tube is? Remember what that tube is? Yeah, it's part of the distal convoluted tubule. I never noticed this up here, but maybe this is as good a figure as the previous one. Yeah, this is really nice, right? Here is Bowman's capsule, proximal convoluted tubule, descending loop of Henle, ascending loop. Then we get into the distal convoluted tubule, and look where it goes by. It's just not laying around anywhere inside the kidney. It goes by exactly between the afferent and efferent arterioles. And it forms the juxtaglomerular apparatus. All right, let's go back to this figure right here. So are you oriented pretty well? Can you see the afferent, efferent arteriole and the distal convoluted tubule going right by it? Okay, this whole area is the juxtaglomerular apparatus, and it has two main components. It has cells in the wall of the distal convoluted tubule that have special sensors, and it can also send out signals to control other parts of the kidney and other parts of your body. This is called the macula densa. Macula densa is one part of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. The other part are these cells that actually make up the wall of the afferent arteriole. And these are smooth muscle cells that can constrict, right? And it causes vasoconstriction. Vasoconstriction reduces blood flow to the glomerulus. And these are what we call, they actually run around with a couple different names, granular cells, because when you look underneath the microscope, you see a bunch of granules inside of them, things that they're going to be able to secrete into the blood. And so they're called granular cells. Sometimes they're called juxtaglomerular cells. Sometimes they're called JG cells. JG. That means they're named after me, right? Not quite. Okay, but just remember, JG cells, granular cells, all the same thing. Well, the macula densa cells can sense low blood pressure. And when low blood pressure is sensed, they send a signal to the granular cells, and the granular cells secrete a very important enzyme into the blood, and that's called renin. I don't know if we went over renin because we didn't talk about it in the endocrine system, because it's really not an endocrine, it's not a hormone, it's actually an enzyme. And eventually what that enzyme does is that it raises blood pressure. And this is really fun to learn about this in physiology, and it helps raise blood pressure because renin causes, through a couple steps, causes the release of aldosterone. I think you've heard of aldosterone before when we were in the endocrine chapter. Aldosterone is a steroid, comes from the adrenal cortex, and aldosterone helps resorb sodium from filtrate, so you don't lose it in your body. So you absorb salt basically from filtrate before you pass it as urine, and when salt re-enters your body, it brings water along with it. And that water ends up in your cardiovascular system. So what happens to blood pressure when we put some water into it with electrolytes, or we increase blood volume? What happens to blood pressure when blood volume increases? Think of your car tire. We put air in, what happens to the pressure? It goes up. Take air out, what happens to the pressure? It goes down, right? And so that's one way you can think of how aldosterone helps regulate blood pressure, because it helps you maintain water, that supports your blood pressure or raises your blood pressure without aldosterone, then you'll be producing a lot of urine. You'll be moving fluid out of your blood. Your blood pressure will go down when you take fluid out of the blood. So that's one important feature of the juxtaglomerular apparatus that helps regulate blood pressure. Right, so renin is secreted by the granular cells, and that's controlled by the macula densa cells. The macula densa cells also can signal the granular cells and smooth muscle around this afferent arteriole to vasoconstrict. Right, and when they vasoconstrict, that reduces the flow through the glomerulus. And one thing that makes the kidney really healthy is that it should be producing the same amount of filtrate no matter what your blood pressure is. Right? So when plasma is flowing into the glomerulus, the amount of fluid that is moving into Bowman's capsule should remain relatively constant. But sometimes our blood pressure goes way up. When our blood pressure goes way up, it forces a lot of blood into the glomerulus and a lot more leaks out into Bowman's capsule. That's not healthy for us or the kidney. All right, so the macula densa cells can sense that, and it signals these cells around the afferent arteriole to constrict. And even though there's high blood pressure, that reduces the flow back to normal in the glomerulus. And that means then that the amount of filtrate that's being produced is normal, even though your blood pressure increases. All right, so your blood pressure is the driving force for moving through fluid through your vascular system. If that pressure increases, that fluid is going to move faster, right? If we want the same volume of fluid moving through the glomerulus when the blood pressure increases, we got to increase the resistance in this afferent arteriole. Okay, so this is the juxtaglomerular apparatus right at the entrance to the renal corpuscle. Remember, renal corpuscle is part glomerulus and part Bowman's capsule. Put them together, you get the renal corpuscle. These mesangial cells, in your notes, it says we don't really know what the function is, but some people are beginning to understand what their function is, but we're not going to go over that. But I just want you to know that this juxtaglomerulus apparatus is important for two things. And let's see if I have it on the slide right here, two things that it does. Okay. Yeah, it's in here, but it's not labeled one and two. So let's just say what it is. Number one, the juxtaglomerular apparatus helps regulate blood pressure. Blood pressure. And if you want to know the name of a compound that helps the juxtaglomerular apparatus do that, write down renin. R-E-N-I-N. Renin. Just one N in there. Renin. All right, the other thing that the juxtaglomerular apparatus does is that it adjusts the blood flow through the glomerulus, keeping the amount of filtrate that's produced constant. The amount of filtrate that's produced sometimes is called, well, all the time is called the glomerular filtration rate, or GFR. The other thing that the juxtaglomerulus does is that it keeps GFR constant. It maintains a constant GFR even though blood pressure could be going up or down. So those are the two important functions of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And you know where it is, right? So every nephron has one of these things. Okay, so what tubular element contains a part of the juxtaglomerular apparatus? What tubular element? The distal convoluted tubule. And where does it have to pass through? It has to pass right between the afferent and efferent arteriole. And when it has the right structures and the right relationships, then that can help regulate blood pressure and help regulate GFR, right? GFR, glomerular filtration rate. All right, so what else we want to talk about? Blood vessels. I didn't talk about blood vessels, so let's find some blood vessels to look at. And that's pretty close. This is even better. All right, so here we have a nice coronal section of a kidney, and I can see the cortex, and I can see the medulla. The medulla contains primarily what two structures? And these you can even see with your naked eye. Okay, it has these triangular shaped structures, which are pyramids, and then it has these more linear shaped structures between the pyramids, which are columns. Right, so if you think of the medulla, think of pyramids and columns. Right, and then another pyramid, another column, kind of goes all the way around. That's the medulla. And then the cortex is the more superficial part of the kidney. And there's a really nice, easy way to recognize the difference between the two is because there are a couple of blood vessels. There's an artery and a vein right on that separation. Right, and this is what's called the arcuate artery and arcuate vein. If it's an artery, it's going to be relatively high in oxygen, so it's going to have a red color. If it's a vein, it's going to be relatively low in oxygen, and it's going to be colored blue. Right, so what are the names of some of these things? What is the name of the artery that brings blood into the whole kidney at the hilum? Right, here's that entrance or exit to the kidney, that's the hilum. And here is a blood vessel bringing blood into the kidney. You should know this to be the renal artery. Indeed, renal artery. And how many renal arteries does one kidney have? It just has one, right? So here's one renal artery. And then it bifurcates, right? After, and I can see a bifurcation right here. So here's a segment of that bifurcation. These are what we call the segmental arteries. So you got what? Renal artery, segmental artery. As the segmental artery passes between the renal pyramids, right, we give it another name. We call it an interlobar artery. And where do I see? Here's a nice interlobar artery coming from a segmental artery. And this is called interlobar because sometimes people consider these pyramids lobes of the kidney. We see it in cross-section and it looks like a triangle, but it really is a cone inside the kidney and looks more like a lobe if you consider the whole kidney. So interlobar arteries. And then the interlobar arteries course right at the base of a pyramid, right? And it demarcates the separation between the cortex and the medulla. And we're going to call this the arcuate arteries, right? Because they form this little arch over the base of the pyramid. And then coming off the arcuate arteries, and this is where I want to zoom in a little bit more, zoom, 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 right? So here's interlobar, here's interlobar artery, sorry, I got my colors confused for a second, interlobar artery, arcuate artery, and you see some other branches coming off the arcuate, and they course up into the cortex. These are what we call the cortical radiate arteries, because it kind of reminded somebody of like sun rays emanating from the sun, right? Light rays coming from a light source. Radiate arteries, they just radiate out into the cortex. All right, and then we looked at the vascular elements of the nephron. I think maybe I won't go over that, except I'll say it really fast. Hopefully you can, I don't see it on this diagram, except one of them I might see, but what are the vascular elements of a nephron? The first thing is afferent arteriole. The next one is glomerulus. The next one is efferent arteriole. Nice. Efferent arteriole brings blood to the peritubular capillary. Peritubular capillary empties blood into a venule, and that's where we can pick it up right now. The venule empties blood into a cortical radiate vein in this particular case, then a arcuate vein, then a segmental vein, interlobar vein in between the pyramids. And then the interlobars empty blood into a segmental vein. And I'm going to have to zoom back out. Segmental vein. And then all the segmental veins drain blood into the renal vein. And who knows where this renal vein is attached? Where is this renal vein attached? Where does blood go when it's in this renal vein? Think about that a second. It's going back to the heart. That's a clue. The inferior vena cava. So when you're doing your dissection, if you want to find out for sure if this is a vein or an artery, just do a little dissection of this blood vessel, and if it goes back to the inferior vena cava, it's got to be the renal vein. But if there's a tube at the hilum right here and it goes to the aorta, then it's got to be the renal artery. Right, so that would be one way, if it's not colored red or blue like it should be. Right, there's no guarantee that your pig would have those colors in there, but that's the plan to do that.
This
question.
Diagram in the next figure, neither of them have Buddhism has segmental things. Do we need to know that?
Only segmental arteries. Yeah, follow the same scheme as arteries.
Okay.
So interlobar veins, right? And when they join together in this region, do I see something? Probably here would be a segmental vein, right? And then renal vein. Yeah, just follow the same scheme. Okay. All right, so that's for blood vessels. And I think that's really all I need to talk about in this urinary chapter. Nice. Okay, so I'll put this away. Question?
Yeah, in the book says there is no segmental veins.
The book says no segmental veins. Okay. I don't know how to reconcile that with my memory. But you don't have a lead line for any of these things. Where is it? Right here. You don't have a lead line, so you can't misrepresent any of these. Right? You got the interlobar veins, right? And the renal vein. Yeah, I would like for there to be a lead line right in this region right here, called a segmental vein. Since there's no lead line, I can't ask you the name of this thing. Okay. So that's it for urinary system. And what chapter is next? Did I miss a question anywhere? I didn't miss a question. Okay. Let's put urinary system away. And I see a question. The urinary bladder section, I think well enough. Okay. Urinary bladder. Some people in lab have asked me, and I see it very clearly here. All right, so here is a nice coronal section through the urinary bladder, and the urinary bladder stores urine until there's a proper time to void, and urine comes from a kidney via ureters. It has two ureters, right? And where the ureters empty into the bladder, right? We call these the uretic orifices, so urine drains into the urinary bladder, and then urine, when it's voided, goes through the urethra. And there are some sphincters around the urethra that prevent the leakage of urine from the urinary bladder. Right? One is involuntary, the internal is involuntary, the external sphincter is voluntary, so you have actually two of these things, two sphincters. And the material, or the view of the inside of the urinary bladder, which is bounded by the orifice of the urethra and the two ureters, forms a nice triangle, and it has a different surface structure, and that's called the trigon, right, between the two ureters and the urethra. The ureters right here, when they empty into the bladder, there is no sphincter. And so you might wonder, well, what prevents urine from going from a urinary bladder pushing back up into the kidney if there is no way to close off the ureter? And the reason is, I think you're going to have to take maybe a garden hose or maybe use one of the tubes in lab. If you have a tube and there's fluid moving through the tube and you bend the tube so that it folds back on itself and you put a kink in the tube, what happens to flow in that tube? Yeah, it stops it, right? So there is that similar kind of kink that's placed right here in the ureter as it empties into the urinary bladder. So just the way that the ureter attaches to the urinary bladder prevents urine from moving back up into the kidney. There's just a little bend right there, puts a little kink in the ureter, and that's used as a sphincter, right? And I don't see any kink right here in the urethra. That is controlled by sphincters. Right. In the male, I still see a trigon. Right? I see the two ureters, but the urethra is a lot longer because it's got to go not only through the urogenital diaphragm, which are muscles of the floor of the pelvic cavity. Sometimes we call that the perineum. But the urethra also has to go through a couple glands. It's got to pass through the prostate gland, which is just inferior to the urinary bladder, right? And then the urogenital diaphragm, and then the urethra has to pass through the penis as well. So it's a little bit different arrangement. We're going to look at this arrangement when we get into the next chapter. What is kind of interesting is that, and I don't see it on this diagram, but there are some tubes from a testes called the vas deferens, and they go through the inguinal canal back up into the pelvic cavity from the testes, and then it actually passes through seminal vesicles and the prostate, and then ejaculate is emptied into the urethra. This is the point I want to make. So the reproductive system in the male, right, and the urinary system in the male join together to form one duct, right? And that's what we call the prostatic urethra, membranous urethra, or penile urethra. That is both for functions, both for reproduction and excretion. But in the female, that never happens. At least in, I'm sorry, the human female, that never happens. Right? So here is the whole extent of the urethra, and nowhere does any part of the reproductive tract join with the female urethra. And this would be in the region of the vagina and vestibule. They never join together. All right, so that is the important thing about the urinary bladder. The other thing, you probably know something about the endothelium or the epithelial layer that lines the inside of the urinary bladder. Who can remember how we classify that endothelium? Yeah, it has a really nice characteristic shape. It is what, the transitional epithelium. It's a stratified epithelium, but the cells really aren't cuboidal or columnar or squamous. They kind of look like a pillow to me, right? And they can stretch out, so this is a shape-shifting endothelium. When the bladder is full, those cells get really flat. After voiding, when the bladder constricts back down, then those cells become shorter but taller as a result of that. Okay, so that is the urethra. Both males and females have, right, a autonomically controlled sphincter and a voluntary sphincter. Okay, and this voluntary sphincter, what can you do with this muscle right here in the floor of the pelvic cavity, since it is skeletal muscle? You can exercise it voluntarily, right? And a lot of people do. That helps them control incontinence, which is what? Leakage of urine through the urethra, just by exercising this muscle right here. That's a pretty famous kind of exercise to do. Does anybody know what the name of that exercise is? It's called a Kegel. K-E-G-E-L, Kegel exercise. And what's one thing that you learned in this class that you really hate? What's good for you? Exercise and diet, and that Kegel exercise is wonderful. All right, so that's an exercise everybody should be doing. Doesn't matter if you're male or female. Okay, so now I'm done with urinary system. Unless you have a question, another question about urinary system? Okay. All right, let's move on to our next one, which is diversification system. All right, now why on earth do I call it the diversification system? So we're going to have to just talk about this for a second, think about it. Okay, diversification system, another name for that is reproductive system. I kind of use them interchangeably in humans. That's pretty good. So I have a bunch of questions. How many sexes are there for humans? Yeah, you got males, right? And we put that away, and then you also have females. And it looks really complicated. Why on earth do some people have a uterus and other people have a penis, right? And we have all these different kinds of structures. It seems really, really complicated to me, and we got to know why that is. Well, I want to think of another kind of organism, okay? And I want to think of a polyp that lives in water, And a hydra would be one that lives in fresh water, but a coral animal would be one that lives in salt water that makes coral, right? And they have a body tube, and on top of the body tube, they have a mouth, an opening into the body tube, and then above that, they have a bunch of tentacles that stick out. Do you have a picture of what I'm talking about, like a little sea anemone that has a bunch of tentacles? And they have stinging cells on the tentacles when a little food particle, living little microorganism or shrimp or something comes by, it can sting the shrimp with a nematocyst, right? And then the tentacle does what with the prey? Brings it over to the mouth, right? Puts it in the mouth into the body tube and it's digested. So that's how that organism lives. And we're all glad we're not just a polyp because that's how they eat. And how do they excrete? Same orifice, right? So I like our design a whole lot better. Okay. Well, when that polyp reproduces itself, it just forms a bud on the side of the body tube, forms a little bump, and the bump gets a little bit bigger and bigger still, and then all of a sudden some tentacles grow out of the bud, and it's beginning to look like another polyp or another hydra. And when it gets big enough, it just breaks away from the body tube or the parent plant. I don't want to say mom plant or dad plant because it really doesn't make sense. It's just a parent plant. It breaks away. Now you have another hydra right next to it. So you got the parent hydra and the offspring hydra. And how would you think of those two different individuals in terms of is one going to be different than the other? They're going to be exactly the same. Okay, that's what we call asexual reproduction. So is that how we reproduce? All of a sudden, do we have like a little bud, and then all of a sudden, you know, we have another Richard or another Joel or another David right there running around? Okay, it doesn't happen that way. So our reproductive system is a lot more complicated, as we see right here. And I guess I have some more questions. I think you answered the first one. How many sexes do we have? You've got two, right? How come we don't have three sexes or four sexes? That's a possibility. Or why do we have only one sex? I mean, why don't we have one sex? Why is it two? I don't want to answer that right at the moment, but that's a really good question to think about. Why are there only two sexes? Well, we got to know what the purpose of the reproductive system is to answer that, and then it will be obvious why that is so. Okay, to get into an understanding of that, your parents made you at some point in time, right? Maybe even if you're a test tube baby, right? Somebody had an egg from your mom and sperm from your dad, put them together, and you were conceived in a test tube, or maybe naturally, it really doesn't matter. But at one point in time, everybody in here had a mom and a dad, right? And so they made you. Could your mom and dad make another you exactly like you, like an identical twin, maybe 5 years later or 10 years later on down the line? Is it possible for that to happen? Okay, and I see everybody shaking their head no, and you're shaking your head no because it has never happened, at least as far as I know, but it's possible, right? If it was possible to make you, then it's possible for your parents to make another you 5 years later, 10 years later, or whatever. But the chances of that happening are so small, so minuscule, that it just never happens. Right? It just never happens. So if you look at you, are you exactly like your mom? Sometimes, some people are kind of close sometimes, but exactly like your mom, you're not an identical twin. Exactly like your dad? No. Right? And are you exactly like any of your brothers or sisters? Sometimes close, but not exact copies, right? So the purpose of the reproductive system is to make something new and unique. If you were to look all over the world or go to a sporting event and there are a million people in the Coliseum watching a football game and you look at everybody, would you find another you? You wouldn't find another you, right? Even if all of your cousins were there and everything. So the purpose of the reproductive system is to make new and unique people. I mean, we're all the same species, but we're all different from each other. Right? And so, that kind of answers why we only have two sexes. We only need two sexes because if we look at everybody, everybody is different. That's the purpose of the reproductive system, to introduce diversity into our population, and diversity produces a lot of strength in the population. So if there is a flu virus going around, do we all come down with that flu virus? Chances are somebody's not going to catch it because their immune system is a little bit different, at least to that particular virus. So the importance of diversity is that if something strange happens, like an infection goes through the population, we're not all going to catch it, right? We're not all going to die. It's not going to cause extinction of our species. So diversification is a very important principle for maintaining the health of a species. And that's why we have all of these different organs in our body, right? Males have, like what we looked at, penis, right? Females have vaginas. Because of the way that our chromosomes are combined in different ways when somebody is conceived. And that produces that diversity. Okay. Has anybody ever bumped into another you? Ever? Never. Nobody could ever prove me wrong.
Twins?
Now, identical twins will be identical. This is true. And so there can be different kinds of identical twins. We could talk about that sometimes. But there can also be sometimes non-identical twins, right? And that's when different sperm and different eggs get together at the same time to produce really vastly different kinds of people, really two unique individuals. Okay, so we're going to get into talking about anatomy. Now we understand sort of why it's there. Does anybody have a question about why I think the purpose of the reproductive system is to produce something that's new and unique as opposed to other organisms that just produce the same thing over and over and over again, right? So a reproductive system produces something new and unique. Another thing that I want to mention, it's the first item here on this slide. It's called the Baby Safe program. A lot of states in the United States, or maybe all of them now, have this particular program. And you can look at this site. This is a really good site that explains it a little bit better. It started way back in 1999 in Texas. And what this law states is that when you have a newborn baby and you have no way to care for that baby, that you can give it up for adoption and you'll have no legal responsibility or ethical responsibilities to raise that child. And the purpose of that law is just to prevent a lot of newborns from being tossed aside and then just killed by whatever process that befalls them. Right? So it saves a lot of lives. And this month in LA County, two babies were given up for adoption. And this year so far, I think in LA County, I think there has been six already given up. And the place where you can give them up is a police station, a fire station, and any hospital will take care of a baby too. And then they're adopted by somebody that wants to have a family. So you might want to pass it around. Who's never heard of a baby safe law? Never heard of a baby safe law. Everybody heard of baby safe? Well, then I don't really need to be talking about it anymore. Okay? But it used to be pretty, nobody used to know about it. Okay. So now we're ready to move into the first reproductive system, which is the male reproductive system. Okay. Male reproductive system. Here is a really important exam figure. And I think it goes over pretty much everything that I see on the slide so far. Okay. Including the primary and secondary reproductive structures or organs. The primary one is the testes. And the testes is responsible for producing sex hormones. And there's one important sex hormone in the male, and that is called testosterone, right? And testosterone helps maintain other secondary male sex characteristics, right? And I can see some here. I can see a penis, right? I can see seminal vesicles and a bunch of other glands. So let's look at some of these other glands. Oh, I forgot to say something about the testes, right? It produces sex hormones, but it also produces something else, and that is something we call a gamete. It's a human cell, but think of it cut in half. It's half of a human cell, right? And that is nice to think of it that way because it's going to join with another half human cell from a female, right? And when a half human male and a half human female cell come together, then you get what? A whole human cell once again. And what is that process when these half cells join together? What is that called when these two half cells join together? Everybody knows, but I'm talking about it a little bit strange way. It's called, don't groan, it's called fertilization, right? Fertilization. Those half cells are what we call gametes, right? The scientific name is a gamete. And what do we call a male gamete, a half-human male cell? Sperm, right? And what do we call a female gamete? An egg. That's right. So when a sperm and egg join together, we call that fertilization. All right, so then we get a human out of that. All right, so that's the job of the testes, production of sperm as well as male hormones, sex hormones. And notice where the testes is. It's not inside the pelvic cavity. It is outside the pelvic cavity in a little pouch that we call the scrotum. And so there's got to be a connection between the pelvic cavity and the scrotum, like blood has to get in there, blood has to come out, nerves have to get in there, right? And all of those things together form the spermatic cord. I'll show you a picture of spermatic cord, all the little components in just a little bit. But the reason, there's a very special reason why the testes are outside the pelvic cavity. Does anybody have a idea why they might be outside the pelvic cavity in the scrotum? Yeah, it's cooler in the scrotum right here. The testes can't perform its normal function if it is at normal human body temperature. It's got to be colder than that. And that's when spermatogenesis takes place, when it's a little bit colder. And the other thing is that if a testes is at normal body temperature, like what, 98.6, something in that range, it has a very high propensity to turn cancerous. And so that's another reason that it's in the scrotum right here. And that's a really good reason why, if you ever have, maybe you raise animals, dogs, cats, you have children at home, that's why we always find out if the testicles are in the scrotum, right? They're not retained in the pelvic cavity, because if they're retained in the pelvic cavity, then that could lead to testicular cancer, right, which is deadly. Okay, and there should be two, right? If you check, there should always be two. If there's one, then one is retained in the pelvic cavity. It's hidden. You can't palpate it. We call that crypt orchidism. Sometimes this organ that makes gametes is called an orchid. And crypt, what does anybody know what crypt means? Crypt orchidism, crypt, like cryptography, is a way of decoding secret messages. So crypto means hidden. So crypt orchid is a hidden testes within the pelvic cavity. It's not down in the scrotum. And then that testes has to be removed. Okay, so that's the job of the testes, primary sex reproductive organ. And it produces sperm. Let's consider that sperm move into a bunch of really small tubes that line the outside of the testes. This is what we call the epididymis. We're going to see another picture of epididymis in a little bit. This is where immature sperm go to mature. And so they're not motile. Sperm are motile because they have a special kind of organelle. Tell me what that organelle is that gives motility to a sperm, and that is a flagellum. Yeah, flagellum. And so they go, the sperm, immature sperm, go from the testes into the epididymis to mature so that they gain motility. And then when it's time for ejaculation, the sperm move from the epididymis into the vas deferens, which carries it through the inguinal canal, up over the top of the urinary bladder, and it's going to pass a couple organs before it gets to the outside world. And I'm not going to tell you the functions of these right now. The epididymis passes through the seminal vesicles. Seminal vesicles add volume to the ejaculate. As a matter of fact, most of the volume of the ejaculate comes from the seminal vesicles, so it has a nice particular function. And then here is a duct from the seminal vesicles through the prostate, and the prostate gland also adds volume to the ejaculate. And this duct through the prostate gland is no longer called the vas deferens or ductus deferens. It is called the ejaculatory duct. Now, here's something a lot different than in the female. The ejaculatory duct joins with the urethra. Right, here's the urethra coming from the urinary bladder within the prostate. So this is what we call the prostatic urethra. And remember, this is the way that urine leaves the body. Then the urethra has to go through the perineum. And so this is what we call the membranous urethra, kind of a short segment. And then the urethra enters the penis, and so sometimes we call this the penile urethra. But also it has another name because this material that makes up the penis kind of looks like a sponge. It has a lot of small caverns in it, a lot of small sinuses, right? And blood can flow into these sinuses and produce an erection. And so sometimes when we look at all these little cavernous spaces inside of a penis, we call it, kind of looks like a sponge. So sometimes we call this the spongy urethra. Spongy urethra, penile urethra is the same thing. Okay, I got carried away and forgot to mention something. I missed something on the way outside the body. Here's that external urethral orifice, right, for urine and for ejaculate. But I missed the bulbourethral gland. Here it is right here. Right? So it also empties into the penile urethra. It adds volume to the ejaculate and even secretes before ejaculation, and it secretes a compound, well, that you're familiar with. It's mucus. Right? We talked about mucus before. Mucus is a protein, and it can act as a lubricant, of course, but it also acts, importantly, as a buffer. It can regulate pH, the acidity. Right? So usually, the female vagina is acidic, and the urethra in the male is acidic, and that acidity helps prevent infection. So that's a normal thing. It helps prevent bacterial infections. But that acidity will also inactivate sperm. Right? So it will decrease sperm motility. And so this mucus right here acts as a buffer. It brings the pH back to a more normal, neither basic nor acidic. So that maintains the function of the sperm. And so that's another important function of mucus. It's a buffer. It helps regulate pH in the vagina and also in the male urethra. Okay, so those are secondary sex structures. And I think we want to go to, oh, here's another, let's talk about this view right here too. Here's sort of a coronal view, right? And I see a nice scrotum for sure. I see a testes, I can see some epididymis. And now I can see, can I see the vas deferens? I can't really quite see the vas deferens, but it's in here. I see a vein, this nice blue color. And do you see anything red in there? I hope you see something red in there. Yeah, okay, so that's the testicular artery. Right, and this yellow thing, I'm just making this up, but this kind of looks yellow to me right here. That's the testicular nerve. And then we have some sheaths that surround all of this and a muscle. Here's the vas deferens. Right here, it kind of disappears, and maybe I can trace it back down here to the epididymis. So we got testicular artery, testicular nerve, testicular vein, vas deferens. We have some fascia, which is connective tissue around that whole apparatus. And we have some other layers, like the tunica vaginalis, right, that surrounds the testes right here. These are just layers. Tunica is just, it means a coat of something. And there is also a muscle. Here's a cremaster muscle that can constrict, and it can elevate the testes up toward the body wall. And all of these things together make something we call the spermatic cord. So spermatic cord is testicular artery, testicular vein, testicular nerve, vas deferens, some connective tissue sheaths right here, and a cremaster muscle. Where it goes through the perineum, we call that the inguinal canal. Right? So the vas deferens has to enter the pelvic cavity to get to the seminal vesicles and prostate and eventually into the penis over here. So that the slide shows a lot. One last thing that this shows. What about that vein, testicular vein? Is it a straight tube, a straight simple tube? Or how would you describe the testicular vein? The hint is, it's the blue thing right there. I see a lot of blue, so I know what I'm talking about. It's this blue thing. Okay, yeah, I see a plexus. I see a whole bunch of branches, and then it comes back together again, and branches once again. So this is what we call the pampiniform plexus, venous plexus, and it surrounds the testicular artery. Testicular artery is bringing blood to the testes, and as blood leaves the pelvic cavity, what temperature is it? When it's in the pelvic cavity, what temperature is your blood? Yeah, 98.6, right? Which is way too high a temperature for this testes down here. So what should happen to that blood before it gets to the testes? It should cool down, right? And what this pampiniform plexus does, it's a heat exchange mechanism, sort of like the radiator in your car. When blood is returning to the body, it's been down here in the scrotum a while, it's a little bit cooler than body temperature, and it flows over the testicular artery, or the plexus flows over the testicular artery. There's heat exchange, so heat goes from the artery into the vein, and when heat leaves the artery, what happens to the temperature? It decreases. So this pampiniform plexus is a nifty way to cool down the blood in the testicular artery before it gets to a testes. So that's a really interesting feature. I've heard that if guys wear really tight-fitting jeans all the time, and these testes are up against the wall of the abdomen or pelvic cavity, that they might have fertility problems as a result of that. Okay? Just a little heads up for anybody. Okay, anatomy of a testes. It's about 4 to 5 centimeters in length. Here's a nice cross-section of a testes. And here is the capsule, the fibrous capsule of a testes. And I can see some invaginations of this capsule. We call these septations. It forms little rooms or septa within the testes. And I can see some tubes. These tubes are not drawn to scale. They are actually microscopic. And we're going to call these seminiferous tubes. And this is where spermatogenesis takes place. This is where sperm are built. Okay. And these seminiferous tubules, the spaces between the seminiferous tubules is responsible for secreting testosterone. Okay. When immature sperm are produced, then they move through this little tube right here, which is called a straight tubule. And then sperm move into the Reedy's testis. It's another kind of like a plexus right here. Almost pulled sperm, but most of the sperm is held within this efferent ductule, right? And the epididymis, where it gains competence, where, in a sense, it learns how to swim. Okay? The flagella become activated. Oh, look at this nice pampiniform plexus once again. Okay, I think we want to look at a cross-section of a seminiferous tubule. Okay, so here is one seminiferous tubule, and you can see the cells, so this is what a nice micrograph. And there are some special germ cells that undergo a process called meiosis that produces a sperm. And because of that process of producing sperm, all the sperm in here are different. They could all be the same. But the chances of that happening, it just doesn't happen because of that process of meiosis. So all these sperm are different, right? And they're tucked within these cells, other cells that help nourish them. Those are what we call Sertoli cells. They help support spermatogenesis. They remove toxins, bring nutrients to the developing sperm. And so the Sertoli cells are inside the seminiferous tubules. And they support spermatogenesis. They need testosterone to perform their function. Testosterone is produced by cells that are outside of the seminiferous tubule. All right, so can I see any cells outside the seminiferous tubule? Okay, I can see some here. Oh yeah, nice. So here's a tubule, nice basement membrane. Here's the basement membrane of another. Here's some cells between the seminiferous tubules. Sometimes we call these interstitial cells, and interstitial cells sometimes are called cells of Leydig, L-E-Y-D-I-G. These are the ones responsible for secreting testosterone. male sex steroid. So Leydig cells secrete testosterone. Sertoli cells help support spermatogenesis. They're dependent on testosterone from these interstitial cells. All right, so that's the testes pretty much. Okay, nice spermatocord once again. This is probably an exam figure as well. All right, so we're going to go over some of these ducts once again. All right, so here's the testes. Produces sperm and testosterone. Epididymis right here, a little holding pattern where sperm gain competence. During ejaculation, sperm then move back up into the pelvic cavity through the inguinal canal. It's not shown on this slide, but you know it's right there. So this is the vas deferens. That's what I like to call it. Other people might call it the, what's another term for vas deferens that you heard? Ductus deferens. Yeah, ductus deferens and vas deferens are exactly the same thing. And it goes over the posterior and superior part of the urinary bladder, and then it comes back over here through the seminal vesicles. Right? Seminal vesicles produce about 60% of the ejaculate volume, and it produces nutrients. Those sperm need energy. They need a sugar. That sugar is fructose. So the seminal vesicles secrete fructose into the ejaculate. It also secretes prostaglandins. These prostaglandins can stimulate uterine contractility or control contractility in the female reproductive tract. There are also other agents from the seminal vesicles that aid in activating the flagellum of a sperm so that it can swim around. There are also some coagulants. What the heck is a coagulant? Your blood can coagulate. It can, blood coagulation forms a blood clot, so it can take a fluid like blood and turn it into more something that's a solid that can't flow one way or the other. All right, so there are coagulants from the seminal vesicles, because when sperm is deposited in the vagina, since it's a fluid, it could just run right out. But since those coagulants are there, it forms a little plug so that those sperm can't just flow right out right away, and then that little plug slowly dissolves away, releasing sperm over a period of time, so it isn't lost. And there's also a pigment, okay, from the seminal vesicles that fluoresces, and I don't think anybody has the slightest idea why it is there, what the function is, except it's very easy to identify, okay, with just a little ultraviolet light. I don't know what color it shines, probably a blue of some kind. And you probably maybe even read about such a thing on the news. So that's the seminal vesicle. Then, ejaculate moves through the ejaculatory duct into past the prostate. The prostate adds ejaculate, about 30% of the volume. And the prostate produces, again, some buffering agents to neutralize the acidity of the male urethra, female vagina. That helps maintain sperm motility. Right. The prostate also adds motility agents to the ejaculate and some coagulants as well. And also something that will eventually break that plug of sperm down, and that's called a liquefying agent, like a prostatic-specific antigen. All right, so the proper release of sperm within the vagina. Within the perineum, I see that bulbal urethral gland. It adds some ejaculate to the some volume to the ejaculate, not very much, just a percent here and there, maybe as much as 5%. And who can remember what that compound is that the bulbourethral glands secrete into the mucus, which is again a buffer. It neutralizes acid, also provides lubrication. All right, so nice figure. But now I can see a little bit more of the penis. And I can see the sinuses, I can see the spaces. This is erectile tissue. There are two major kinds of erectile tissue in the penis. All right, first one, corpus spongiosum. And the corpus spongiosum is part of the erectile tissue that the urethra passes through. So it's more central, right? It's more medial. The other erectile tissues are on either side of the spongiosum, and we call these the cavernosa. cavernosa is plural. And if we're talking about both of these, then we're going to call these the corpora cavernosa. Corpora is plural, right? Like corpora quadrigemina is more than singular. There are two, corpora spongiosum. One is a corpus spongiosum, and it is erectile tissue. Another erectile tissue, kind of an extension of the corpus spongiosum, is, right, the glans penis, right here. And at the end of the glans penis, you have the external urethral orifice. That's how urine and ejaculate leave the body. All right, another picture. Ah, here we see erectile tissues. Right, we see the spongiosum with the urethra going through it, and then the two corpora cavernosa. And the corpora cavernosa are on the dorsal penis, and the corpus spongiosum is on the ventral penis. Right, ventral penis. And close your eyes, I want to flip back really fast, just to show you once again. Right, so the spongiosum here is on the ventral penis, and the corpora cavernosa are on the dorsal side of the penis. Okay. Any questions on that? Where you find those things? Okay. Fantastic. We talked about the different parts of the urethra, erectile tissue, and that's pretty much it for the male reproductive system. All right, which takes us to then we talk about spermatogenesis, which takes us to the female reproductive system. All right, so here's female reproductive system. We have nice models of this and also the sagittal view of the male reproductive system. Nice videos online for the practicum. So the primary reproductive organ in female is the ovary. All right, so the job of the ovary is twofold, just like in testes for the male. It produces sex steroids. In the male, there's only one, but in the female, there are two sex steroids, and they are called estrogen and progesterone. All right, progesterone. So females need two, males only need one. And the second job of the ovary right here is to produce gametes. And they're half-human cells. We call those eggs. Okay. So this ovary is in the pelvic cavity. It's not connected to the uterus. There's a tube that helps connect the ovary to the uterus right here, and it's called the fallopian tube, or sometimes the uterine tube. I usually just say fallopian tube. It's a long, squiggly tube, and it's got a narrow part as you get to the uterus, and then it's got a very wide, broad part, okay, as you get to the ovary. And the edge of the wide part of the fallopian tube has a lot of like finger projections coming off of it, and there's smooth muscle in there. Those are what we call fimbria, and the fimbria, since they're like little fingers, are always sweeping over the surface of an ovary, and their job is to collect, right, and capture an egg when it's ovulated from the ovary, right? Because an egg cell can't move on its own. It's got to have help moving around. These fimbria help that motion. Okay? But the lining of the fallopian tube and the fimbria right here are ciliated. What's the function of cilia? Yeah, another for motility once again. And the cilia are all sweeping in one direction. And guess what direction they're sweeping? Toward the uterus. Right? So when an egg is ovulated, gets captured by the fimbria, the cilia help make it or trap it in the flow down into the uterus. That is, if everything goes correctly. All right, so that's a relatively delicate tissue, and it reminded somebody of a musical instrument, and that's how it got its scientific name. And it's really kind of an obscure name. Your book calls it this obscure name. I'm not sure it tells you why they call it that. Okay, what kind of musical instrument does that remind you of, that fallopian tube? Yeah, it reminds me of a trumpet as well, right? Because here's like the mouthpiece that you blow into the trumpet and the music comes out here, that flared open end of a trumpet. And remember, trumpets used to be just straight tubes, but now they're coiled so that they're a little bit shorter. And so the name for a trumpet is called salpinx. Salpinx, S-A-L-P-Y-N-X, sell pinks. And that's how we got that name. And a lot of times when somebody has a inflammation, right, of the reproductive tract, some pelvic inflammatory reaction right here due to infection, then the fallopian tube can become scarred. And it can actually close, it can actually scar closed, in which case eggs can't move down through the fallopian tube. And if just the cilia are damaged, right, then the egg can't move through the fallopian tube. But what about sperm? Sperm are here in the vagina. And what do they have all by themselves? A flagellum, right? So they can swim around. They can swim around through the cervix, through the cervical canal, right, up into the uterus and then into the fallopian tube. And they, even though there's no cilia to move an egg along, those sperms still can swim up over here and fertilize an egg. And then fertilization will take place in a fallopian tube. Right? Or maybe the fallopian tube is damaged to such a degree that an egg starts to float around inside the pelvic cavity, and there's no separation between the pelvic cavity and abdominal cavity, so an egg can actually float around anywhere within that cavity. And what about sperm? Well, they like to go everywhere, right? They can just swim around, they can swim right out the fallopian tube in the pelvic cavity, abdominal cavity, and they can fertilize an egg in those locations as well. And that's a special kind of pregnancy. That's got a really special name. It's a pregnancy in an unusual location, right? It's a pregnancy that's not in the uterus. It's in an unusual location. And what the heck do we call that? A very important clinical term. What kind of pregnancy? Maybe some of you have heard it. It's called an ectopic pregnancy. Ectopic is a pregnancy other than the uterus. It could be fallopian tube. It could be in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity. And anybody that's had any kind of pelvic inflammatory disease for any reason, okay, is at a higher risk of ectopic pregnancy. And that is very dangerous. If we look at the uterus, I can see a layer. The thickest layer right here is what we call the myometrium. So guess what the myometrium is made of, this big thick thing right here. Yeah, muscle, right? It's got to be a big, strong muscle to maintain pregnancy, to support pregnancy. But if there is implantation of an embryo in a different location, like fallopian tube or mesentery in the abdominal cavity or pelvic cavity, there's no smooth muscle. As that blastocyst grows bigger and bigger and bigger, gets heavier, and it rips away from its blood supply, and it causes a massive hemorrhage into the pelvic and abdominal cavities. And that can be fatal in a very short period of time. So ectopic pregnancies are what? Really serious business. And so you really have to be aware of that. And it used to be missed quite frequently in emergency rooms. A woman would come in with pain in her stomach or pelvic region, and nobody could really figure out what's going on, and everybody's busy, so they would say, well, take a couple aspirin and wait till morning, come back if you still feel that pain. And sometimes a woman would never even be able to make it back to the emergency room. They would just bleed out, that massive hemorrhage. So in emergency rooms, they would hang a sign, and that sign said, think ectopic, right? Just to remind people that this is something that you should never miss. So when a woman presents emergency room or any kind of physician with pain, all right, then what do they think? All right, a woman, is she of childbearing years? Is she sexually active? Any history of pelvic inflammatory disease? And if all those things kind of line up, then you really take that ectopic pregnancy seriously, right? And as a matter of fact, if you know anybody that's pregnant and all of a sudden they experience pain in their abdomen or pelvis, right, you should tell them, definitely seek medical advice, because it could be a really serious condition. And that's really sad, of course, when that happens. And sometimes it's really hard to get a woman to go in for that diagnosis because they don't want to face the possibility of losing a child, right? That's really serious. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign that. We got one more lecture.